Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Now the father finds her beguiling.
Watch out, Cece.
And the kids are actually smiling.
Suavity.
She's the lady in red when everybody else is wearing tan. The flashy girl from Flushing.
Hey, welcome everybody to this week's podcast. We're going behind the curtain as always. I'm Paul Listick from WGN TV, and my first guest is just so thrilling to me to get to talk to. I fell in love with her when she was starring in a series that we all watched. You just listened to part of the theme song, The Nanny, with Fran Drescher, and that's one of the times I really saw just such incredible humor and talent with my next guest. But she has a career and a background that if you don't know it, you should. And you'll get to find out a little bit when she comes to Chicago. It is Renee Taylor joining me. The show is My Life on a Diet, and she's going to be appearing at the North Shore Center for the Performing Arts. That's up in Skokie. I just spoke with their artistic director a couple of weeks ago. So, Renee, we talked about a fact that you were coming up a little bit, starting July 16th. You're in Chicago and Skokie.
I'm so excited. It's one of my favorite places in the whole world.
And when I look back on your career, I don't know people, you know, listen, so many people fell in love with you with The Nanny because your role of Sylvia Fine there playing Fran's mother, so iconic, so incredible. And I'm sure that had to be, you know, a wonderful, fun highlight in your career. Am I right? That was a good experience for you and a lot of fun?
Oh, yeah, it still is. I just did a show with Fran a few weeks ago. I was on her cruise for Kansas Schmanza.
So nice. Yeah, and I did a special with her a couple of years back on the same topic, and just an incredible lady. Your career, well, I mean, and I read your book. I know it was written many years ago called My Life on a Diet, but, you know, I just wanted to be sure I knew everything about you, and I know the show is not based on that book. But when I look back to the beginning of your life, it's almost as though you came out of the womb and you decided, I'm going to be a star. Am I far off?
No, I didn't decide. My mother decided.
Okay.
And I went along with it. She said I looked exactly like the famous star she named me after, Renee Adore, who was in Silent Screen. She was in The Big Parade.
Yeah.
And I don't look anything like her, but my mother thought I did.
Well, and also, of course, your real name wasn't Taylor, and I love the way you kind of came up with the name Taylor as being your name for somebody who's going into showbiz.
Well, my name was Wexler, and I went to see a Tennessee Williams about being in Carol Baker played it, Baby Doll. And the only way they were only seeing authentic Southern girls. So I looked up the name in Who's Who in the South, and I came up with General Taylor. And that's who I was, Renee Taylor, and I went there with a heavy Southern accent and auditioned for him. And he said to me, Miss Taylor, what part of New York are you from? So I didn't fool him.
Well, you could be from the South. You're charming, and all the charm goes with you. Let's talk about the show My Life on a Diet, because, again, knowing a lot about your background as I do now, is that a lot of what we're going to see? You know, the book you wrote years ago filled with various diets and suggestions, and this concept of dieting has really kind of followed you through your life. How will that translate to what we'll see on stage up at North Shore?
I just talk about what diets I was on at different points of my life. And I thought if I ate like movie stars, I'd look like one. And it almost worked.
And you share, by the way, in the old book, you, in so many times when you talk to somebody, you then share us, and I'm not sure if they're real or whether you're having fun with it. I really couldn't tell. But you shared the diets of so many of these people. And you often asked people, what do you eat? What's your diet? So that
yes,
really was.
I do. And I would sit down next to them and eat what they ate. And the same size portions, too.
I love it. So in the show, do we get the description? Are we hearing about diets? Are we seeing them posted up? Are we getting?
Oh, yeah, I tell about Joan Crawford, Marilyn Monroe, Grace Kelly, all the people that I asked what they ate, and I ate what they ate.
What a great theory. I mean, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. But plus the people, like, go ahead.
Nora Ephron's show was What I Love Lost and What I Wore. She remembered her life in terms of what everyone was wearing. And I, to this day, when I meet someone, I say, oh, yeah, that's when you and I did the Last Chance diet together.
It's a great way to peg everything in time. People who don't know a lot about your career, and I'm sure we'll hear certain things in the show, but you have worked with amazing people. I mean, listen, I grew up as a huge Jerry Lewis fan, and you were in The Errand Boy. I hope you don't mind me bringing that up, but I love the story.
That was my first movie.
Yeah, and I love the – would you briefly tell the story of how you got Jerry to put you in the movie, because you weren't originally in the movie.
I was on the Jack Parr show, and he said to me, if you're ever in California, look me up. So I flew there the next day. And he said, oh, there's nothing in this movie I'm doing. And I said, well, you wrote it, didn't you? I've seen your movies. Just rip out 5 pages and put in 5 new ones. And that's what he did. And he wrote me a part in The Errand Boy.
Fantastic. You've worked with Sinatra and Klugman in The Detective. I mean, I can go on Perry Como. I almost can't think of anybody from the golden age of television, the golden age of film and Broadway. You really worked with them all, and yet you didn't grow up in that world. I mean, it wasn't like you were surrounded by celebrities growing up, but you propelled by your mom, I guess, but you propelled you to be in that world, and you just aggressively went after it. Is that in a good way, in a successful way? Would that be one of the ways you would just talk about who you are as a person in terms of getting these roles in the early days?
Yeah, I'd show up for everything. I would, if they needed a singer or a dancer, whatever they needed, I'd audition as that. Even though I never sang, never danced, I'd just show up for everything. Eventually somebody will hire me.
Right, exactly. And plus, one of the first vehicles that I remember you, Lovers and Other Strangers, talk about that. Uh-huh. It brings up, obviously, your beloved husband, and my condolences. I know we recently lost him. But what a love affair that was for so many, many years. Unusual in Hollywood.
53 years.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I met him, he was a young commercial director. I was a young actress. We went to the theater. We saw a bad play. I said, oh, let's write a play. I'll star in it and you'll direct it. I know we can write better than that. So that was the first thing we wrote, Lovers and Other Strangers. We sold it to the movies. We were nominated for an Academy Award. We said, hey, this is easy.
We can do it again.
Yeah.
Can I take you back? Because you know what? Again, because I've done so much homework on you, some of the great stories. When you first met him, and again, I want you to tell the story, but you expected him to call you, right? After you met him, you thought he would call you.
Oh, yeah. No, I auditioned as for a commercial. And he said, thank you very much. We'll call you. And then 5 minutes later, the phone rang. I said, I thought you said you're going to call me. I said, are you just one of these guys who say they're going to call, then they don't call? And he says, where are you? I said, I'm in the lobby. He said, I'll be right down.
So that was, again, moxie on your part, right?
It was fun. I just always had fun with him. I always flirted with him.
You also, again, it's public because you talk about it, but I was always intrigued about the games you would even play with him, like in hotels where you would pretend you were picking him up. And there was at least one story you told where he really got the better of you when somebody came over and, you know, had problems with the fact that they thought you had been working the lobby.
Yeah, the house detective asked me to leave the Plaza Hotel. And he said I was upsetting the guests. And I said, oh, no, this is my husband. And we're just having some fun. I'm pretending to pick him up. I said, right, Joe? And he just shrugged. Like he didn't know who I was. And so they took me out to the street. And afterwards I said to him, why'd you do that? I was so humiliated. He says, well, because now I'm going to have to sneak you back into the hotel. It's so much fun.
That was great. I remember, and again, when you wrote about this story, you sort of talked about it, said, I've never seen this woman before, but you said you got a kick out of it. You weren't angry. You said you got a kick out of it.
Oh, yeah. We played all these games all the time.
Is that part of what kept, and for 53 years, is that part of what kept the marriage so magical through the years? I know you've got your son, Gabriel.
So. We'd be someplace, and I'd say to him, who'd you come with? Did you come alone? And he'd say, it depends. What do you have in mind? We would pretend that we didn't know each other.
And the show that we're going to see, When My Life on a Diet, this, it gets to be a bit of a tribute of him. He did help you write. He was part of writing the show.
He wrote it with me, and he directed it.
So when
and
was it?
He still comes backstage and gives me notes.
I love it. When was it for? When did you first perform My Life on a Diet?
Oh, many years ago, but it just kept evolving. You know, changing until it is.
Well, that's
what it is now.
That's what I wanted to ask you because I mean, as we see it now, are we getting? Are we getting recent times? Is it something you're always updating and adding so we get the Renee Taylor who we've known in recent years?
It opened in New York. It got wonderful reviews. Then it went to California. It got wonderful reviews. As a matter of fact, we've never gotten anything but rave reviews. And the audience afterwards comes backstage and they always share with me what diets they're on. They always say, why didn't you say something about the pregnant woman's urine diet or something like that.
Oh, everybody's got something else they want you to talk about.
Yeah, about their favorite diet.
Well, I did. You are right. The reviews, New York Post said it was wonderful. It was priceless. New York Times, Parade Magazine, they really have been great reviews. So how did you pick? I mean, there's so many different theaters to come. You've come up to Skokie, where I grew up, by the way. Was there something magical about selecting that? Because you've certainly been in Chicago through your career. To me, it seems like the right place for you to be.
Oh, yeah. I played It Had to Be You there with my husband, If You Ever Leave Me, I'm Going With You.
Right, yes.
So I had such great experiences in Chicago, and the audiences are so responsive. And I love the town, and I love the lake and the shopping. It's like a dream come true to go back there for 3 weeks to Skokie. That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. Shopping, movie, you got all sorts of things for you. And come on downtown. We got plenty of shows for you to. Oh, you won't get any nights off, so you're going to be pretty busy.
Well, I have Monday off. Is there anything happening on a Monday?
No, I'll take you for pizza.
Okay, I'll take you up on that.
That's if it's
they
on the diet.
Have, they still have Uno pizza?
Sure, but you know, well, I got to be careful about getting into favorite pizzas because you know people are dangerous. But there's other pizzas. When I meet you, I'll tell you we might want to try it as well. Uno's is lovely.
Okay, as long as it's gluten free.
Yeah, we'll get you gluten-free pizza. I never understood gluten-free anyway, but we'll get it for you. So when I read back to your career, I mean, Paul Newman, Marlon Brando, you knew them all. And in your early days with Joe, you even lived in some of these stars' homes. Just an amazing rise for you through the years.
When I first went to California, we lived in Greta Garbo's home.
Yeah.
Great. I used to stay home all day and just feel the wallpaper. That's how beautiful it was.
Am I also right?
And
when
I lived in Carol Lombard's house, Charlie Chaplin's house. Greer Garson, I used to go around just visiting movie star homes.
Well, yeah, many of us did, but we did it on a bus. I also love
the story. I once got on the bus, and I said, okay, let me off here. And they said, this isn't the stop. I said, it's my house. And I invited everybody to get off the bus and come in with me.
Did they?
Yep.
Oh, my God. That's wonderful.
I lived in Shirley Temple's house.
So you're somebody who not only wanted to be a part of Hollywood and the scene and the movies and the Broadway, but it's almost Lucille Ball-esque. In other words, the love of the profession, but you also admired the profession. Was there a sense of which I'm a part of this world that I am so enamored with?
Yes, I was always movie star crazy. And I would just go to award shows just to be able to look at movie stars up close, whereas my husband, when we went to the Academy Awards, I was so impressed meeting Anthony Quinn? Oh, I can't think.
Anthony Quinn?
Quinn, yes.
Yeah.
I said, this is my husband, Joe Below. I couldn't remember his last name. And my husband said, yeah.
So even there, even though you were a star, you'd meet other stars and you were a bit tongue-tied when you would meet them.
Always.
What's new on the...
I would get up with my husband and say, okay, Cary Grant is getting up to dance. And get close to him. And my husband would say, how close? And I say, until I can smell his cologne.
I love it. Now, let me just talk for a moment with you about The Nanny, if I can. I mean, just, again, such an incredible show. Still plays, still everybody's favorite. You worked with such an amazing cast of people. But the magic between you and Anne Morgan Gilbert, who played your mother, Yenta, such classic moments. And by the way, the Elizabeth Taylor scene, given what we've been talking about, must have really been special for you to do.
Oh, that was great. That was great to meet her. And I said, could I take my picture with you? And she said, the press agent said that'll cost $125. And I said, why? And they said, because Miss Taylor, when she takes a picture, she has to look thinner, younger, and more glamorous. And I said, okay, I'll pay the money, but whatever you do for her, do for me.
Was that serious? Were they serious about that?
Yes, I did, because, you know, in those days, they didn't have apps on your phone. You had to retouch things, which is a whole different thing than now.
Oh, right, absolutely. I remember. Yeah, today, right, we can take you and we can add bunny ears onto you and everything else we want to do.
Absolutely. And you can be as thin as you want.
Right. I love it. Well, listen, as far as I'm concerned, you have always been gorgeous, and diet struggles aside, I think you've been an amazing talent. You are an amazing talent and have always been gorgeous. And I've just admired you through the years. And I just can't wait to see you on stage.
Oh, thank you, Paul. Thank you. Please come back at stage and take a picture.
Do I have to pay $150?
No.
Okay.
No, because I have the retouching app on my phone.
You've got the app. You know what? When I meet you, I'm going to tell you another celebrity who you know, where we took a picture together, and I can't tell you what I was put through until she would approve the simple picture we were trying to take and how it had to be right.
Funny.
Yeah, you'll love it when I tell you, especially who it is. But we'll hold that off for a meeting between us. The show is My Life on a Diet. It's at North Shore Center for the Performing Arts, July 16th to August 4th. You got a few weeks in there, which is really nice. You can get tickets. What's that? Three weeks. And the website is northshorecenter.org. They spell center C-E-N-T-E-R. I always feel we should do T-R-E like the British, but we don't. So northshorecenter.org. Yeah. Don't you agree with me?
Absolutely.
It's classier. It's classier. Do not miss Renee Taylor. I can't wait to see it. Pick a night. You'll probably see me in the audience talking to her. You don't want to miss it. One of the great talents from Hollywood, from Broadway, from everywhere. And now she is coming to Chicago. Renee Taylor, God bless you. See you soon. And have a fat break legs every night in Chicago.
Thank you, Joanne. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And joining me now is David Marinus. He is an associate editor over at the Washington Post, but what an incredible author he is, which is the main reason he's joining me today on the podcast. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, which is 2 more than I've won, for journalism. He was a finalist 3 other times, which is 3 more times than I was ever nominated. But his books, meaning I've got nothing, but his books, best-selling on Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, even in the sports world, Roberto Clemente, Vince Lombardi, and not to mention, by the way, a trilogy he wrote about the 1960s. So much that he has written. But we're here to talk about his latest book. It's his 12th book. It's called A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father. You hopefully saw him on Politics Tonight when he joined me when he was in Chicago on his book tour. But I wanted to have a little more time to talk with him now, and he joins me now. David, welcome back to joining me for a discussion. I appreciate it.
Hey, Paul. My pleasure.
So let me start by sort of asking you, after all of the biographies you've done, the look at the 60s, what was it about these days, these recent years, I suppose, that you're working on it, that you said, I need to tell my own family story?
Well, I think it was the fact that I'd written biographies of other people that really led me to this. you know, whether it was Bill Clinton and Barack Obama or Vince Lombardi and Roberto Clemente, they all basically were strangers to me when I started. And I know that most of us really only know the mythology of our own family stories, as did they. And they didn't have a biographer coming along. Most people don't have a biographer coming along behind them to find out the truth. So as I thought about that more and more, I realized that my family had a very defining story that I had not tried to research in the same way I did the books about strangers. So it just felt like something I had to do.
Well, and let me kind of pick up there, because as you then studied your own father, your own family, I guess my question is, in the end, when the book comes out and is published, and you look back on it, was your own father and family a stranger at all to you that you have now come to know?
I think I came to understand my family, my father, and myself better at the end of this process than before I started it. I wouldn't say that they were strangers. It's just I have a very much deeper understanding of the struggles that my father went through as someone who was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee and characterized as un-American, and also sort of the secrets of the family. That was something that was not talked about when I was growing up. It was the shadow of the family, so that certainly had an effect.
And, yeah.
And but, you know, the amazing thing is that my father survived that and came out of it as an optimist, and that also is part of my character, to be optimistic. And so I sort of discovered where that came from, despite the troubles that he'd been through.
Yeah. And of course, when I say stranger, I mean that metaphorically. And it sounds
right.
Like, yes, you learned so much more in depth about your family. If I was to pick a room that really kind of around this story evolves, I'm going to say room 740. And you tell listeners what I'm talking about.
Room 740 was in the Federal Building in Detroit. It's where the House Un-American Activities Committee of Congress from Washington came and held a field hearing in late February and early March of 1952 to examine what they called communism in the Detroit region. And they held hearings for 2 weeks in that hearing room. And among the many people who were called as witnesses were my father and my mother's brother, my uncle Bob Cummins.
And one of the things you wrote about that your dad taught you, which I thought this was interesting, he taught you to be skeptical but not cynical. What's the line?
Well, the line is to always, search for the truth wherever you can find it, but don't think that you know everything beforehand, which is what cynics do. So I think that's, as a journalist, that's the line that, you know, you haven't seen everything before. You don't know all the answers. Anybody who pretends they do have all the answers, whether it's political or journalistic or anything else in life, is fooling themselves and trying to fool you. And so it's a constant search for the truth is the way I describe that.
You wrote that
line of skepticism, but
yeah,
not cynicism.
Yeah. You wrote that your dad loved how words get manipulated for political purposes. I want to take that concept, put it in the world of the McCarthyism hearings your father and your family lived through, and we take a look today. I mean, keep in mind, we have President Trump always saying, I want my Joe McCarthy, I want my Joe, or my Roy Cohn. I want my Roy Cohn, sorry, back from those days. Are we living through a modern version of McCarthy hearings? Obviously, different topic, but are we living through?
I think that history doesn't repeat itself exactly, but there are important parallels between then and now.
Well, you wrote that history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. So maybe that's what we're talking about.
The two important rhymes are that then as now, people in power are using fear as a political tool and manipulating the public through the use of fear. And they're also using words in stretching the truth in ways that are dangerous. So I would say that those two, and the central question of what is an American? Today you have all of the debates over immigration and Latinos and Trump saying that he can't be judged fairly by a Hispanic judge.
Right.
And all of the anti-Muslim sentiment. You know, while there are millions of loyal American Muslims, all of that raises the same questions that were raised during the McCarthy era. So I think those are the main parallels.
And you talked about the fact during McCarthyism, you write about this, it's a world of fear, but also sensationalism, distortion, distraction. I mean, those terms, certainly it appears, are arguably used today. But what you had back then was the ultimate day when someone looked at Joe McCarthy and said, you know, have you no decency, sir? Have you no decency? Can that kind of moment even happen today in the world?
No, I'm not sure. It certainly hasn't happened yet. I mean, there are some conservatives who have stood up to Trump. Not many in Congress. Only one that really comes to mind is Amash from Michigan.
And he's leaving the Republican Party.
He's leaving the party. So, you know, where is the Margaret Chase Smith of today, the main Republican who stood up against McCarthy? You really haven't seen that.
Do we risk, you know, we see the challenges to the Constitution, even currently in the census. You know, the Supreme Court says,
right,
essentially, I don't buy your reasoning for why you want the census, the question on the census. And now the president says, well, maybe I'll just issue an executive order about that. Do you have any concerns about how, and again, I'm coming off your book. This is relevant to me from just reading that book.
Mm-hmm.
The
yeah.
fear of Republicans who don't seem to be defending the Constitution, the challenge to the balance of power.
I think that it all comes down to that last word you said, which is power, not the balance of power, but raw power. And Trump has essentially admitted as much when he said that he wants to use the census question to determine congressional districts, which
right.
is not what the Constitution says about congressional districts. And the Republicans are putting up with Trump or propping him up or using him or accepting him, primarily because it's the only way they see they can stay in power. I think that it all comes down to raw political power on the part of the Republican Party and not to any sort of larger conservative philosophy.
We look at all the potentials for war in this world today, Iran, North Korea, pick your location. And you wrote about your father's service in World War II, World War II, and that after mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor, your father, as you wrote, understood the need for that war. What would your dad think about what was going on today with these various locations in the world?
Well, you know, I can tell you that because of his history after that period of the McCarthy era. He went on to become an editor at the Capital Times in Madison, a very progressive paper, which was one of the first papers in the country to come out against the Vietnam War and really was promoting peace in almost every situation since then. So I know that he would be on that side of any question.
You're a journalist, and you know, whenever you have a journalist, when I have them on my show, when they're anywhere, there's always this line between a journalist taking a position, which they typically should not do, and becoming a pundit. We see you on Meet the Press, Face the Nation. I mean, you're on all of these shows. How do you, for yourself, maintain a distinction between not becoming a pundit, unless that's what you want to be, but you know, recognizing yourself as the journalist that has to be respected for the analysis that you make?
Well, what I've tried to do, and I hope you, the listeners and viewers would see this, is I don't go on those shows unless I consider myself to have knowledge about this particular subject. So I went on the shows because of my book, because I wrote the book, and I know, you know, that subject.
But they won't let you get away with just that. we all want to talk to you about
Barack
life.
Obama, because I wrote biographies of them.
Right.
And, you know, there's been a lot about Trump that I've tried to stay away from being a pundit about, even though I obviously have my own feelings about him, except as it relates to what I see as the parallels with the McCarthy era, which is something that I'm an expert on. So, you know, I've tried as best I can to go on those shows when I have something factual to add or smart analysis to add to the situation and not merely, you know, spouting my ideological beliefs and singing to the choir, which are two things that I try not to do.
As I also recall in the book, now correct me on this, is my memory on this, but you talked about being influenced by your dad, but also George Orwell. Is that memory correct in mine?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so doesn't that tell us a lot about how you see the world, if you're so influenced by George Orwell, author of 1984?
Well, yes. But I mean, the main thing, I actually prefer Orwell's essays to his novels, Animal Farm and 1984, which are, of course, iconic and incredibly important in understanding the modern world. But what I loved about his essays was their clarity and his search for a common sense analysis of the political situation, even if it went against his own basic ideology. So, you know, I think that was Orwell. He was looking for the truth wherever it took him, and he was as tough on totalitarians of the left as of the right, even though he was of the left himself.
Mueller, of course, will soon take to the microphones, claiming he won't talk about anything that wasn't in his report. Given how you understand people are today, you know, because, you know, what Mueller told us, hey, you read my report, go read the book again. Do you agree with this concept that at least Americans tend to prefer the movie over the book? And even if he says nothing more than what was in the report, that it's important that he appear, or is he about to waste his time?
Well, I really don't have an answer to that, except to say that the Democrats will control this process to some degree. And the more that they actually think about it and not just have every congressperson trying to make their own points, but have an orchestrated way and an intelligent way of getting him to explicate what was in the report, then it can work to a certain extent, even if he doesn't go any further than the report. But it really asks a lot of politicians who tend to want to go their own way and make a name for themselves. In this case, it's vitally important for the Democrats to do it right.
You know, I'm sure you know Alan Lichtman and his concept of how he's picked the correct president in the last nine elections, and he's looked at this time and basically said, unless Democrats impeach, at least hold, not that they don't even have to impeach, they have to have impeachment proceedings to air things, the odds are they can't win the election. But my question, again, in a comparison to what you wrote about in A Good American Family and looking at the era of the 50s, the politics of it versus the factual basis, the lack of factual basis of what we're dealing with, I don't think the average person gets to see through it, right? I mean, in other words, it looks like the Democrats' calculation on impeachment is purely this could cost us if we impeach. The notion of doing what's right, if that's what's right to do, just doesn't seem to be a calculation that wins the day.
Well, I think they're too cautious. I think that maybe the Democrats can learn a lesson from the women's soccer team. You know, they just went for it. They didn't worry about anything else, and they won. And I think the Democrats are always trying to play the angles of whether something will hurt them or not, as opposed to just standing up for what they believe in and what they think is right.
You know, on the back in the McCarthy days, of course, that you write about, things were so extreme with him. And then, of course, we saw that taking hold to good parts of the country. You can look back to other parts in our history where that kind of thing plays out. Well, today, of course, you have President Trump on his extreme, detention camps and all that's going on. So it looks like the Democrats are trying to find their world over on the left. Medicare for everybody. You're not a citizen. We'll give it to you, too. You're not legal. Don't worry about it. As a journalist looking at this, do you sort of see danger ahead for Democrats if they go way over to the left, or do you see it as a necessary, potentially necessary response to the right-wing conservatism that they face on the other side of the ballot, if I'm making sense?
Well, this might sound contradicting to what I just said about going for what you believe in, but the majority of Democrats want to maintain their private health insurance and allow for something else to make sure that everybody gets insurance. So in that sense, I think when Democrats talk about Medicare for all and a single-payer option, it's not wise, and not even what a majority of their own people want. So I think they have to be smart about those things. And also, you know, I think that to some degree, Kamala Harris, even as she was, you know, stunningly effective in the debate, you know, she has to be careful about what she says about busing. It's another issue that's loaded in a lot of ways that are hard to unwind from our recent history. So, you know, I think that it requires a politician who can speak the truth without you know, pandering to every possible part of the party.
Yeah, the Democrats may be in trouble if they're going to have a debate over busing from 40 years ago and make that a center.
I think so. I think it was, right? You know, it was effective for the moment, but long-term, maybe not.
So much of your writing, because somebody who's listening to us now might say, wow, the guy goes from Obama and Clinton, and he's got, you know, these baseball players, and what's going on? But I think, as I understand your work, what's important to you, regardless of whether they're coming from sports, history, you try and understand the forces that are shaping and have shaped this country. Is that a fair read on what propels you?
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, some people consider sports to be, you know, the toy department. I don't look at it that way at all. And I've always thought that sports is an important factor in the sociology of this country and reveals a lot about it, whether it's Jackie Robinson or the U.S. women's soccer team. And so I'm always looking for stories in that realm that tell a larger part of the American story, not just, you know, who won and lost. And that's why Lombardi was sort of a symbol of the mythology of competition and success in American life and what it takes and what it costs. Clemente was, you know, representative of the rise of Latinos in America and overcoming a double prejudice of race and language. And so, you know, I think that you can learn as much from those as you can from any study of a politician.
And when you talk about that, I Doris Kearns Goodwin pops into my mind, her book on leadership, and you just see a nice parallel between your writing and some of the leadership concepts she writes about within the scope of certain presidents that she studied. Mm-hmm. But they make for interesting pairing. As you look ahead in the world we're in, can you share with us who the next project is or what's next
up
for you?
Well, interestingly enough, it is in a sense going back to sports, but not because of sports. My next book will be a full-scale biography of Jim Thorpe, the great American Indian athlete.
So what? Okay, and how did you? I mean, yes, familiar with him, but where does that come from?
I think I can use his life story to write about the story of the Native American from the 1880s to the 1950s, and sort of the policy of this country, which was to kill the Indian, save the man, essentially try to get the Indian out of them, and how Thorpe resisted that in different ways, and the mythology that was built up around him and the American Indian during that period.
Well, I will look forward to that one and chatting with you when that time comes. For now, and I got to tell you, and I told you this when I met you, but there are some huge fans of yours here in this newsroom.
Oh, that's nice.
I have one woman particularly in mind who is just she immediately grabbed The Good American Family out of my hands because she wanted to read it. I told her to go buy a copy herself, by the way. And I'm always thinking ahead for my fellow authors.
Thank you. Yeah.
And so just your work is amazing, and your career is amazing, and it's why you get the Pulitzer Prize every couple of days. So I think it's fantastic. The book is called A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father. If you read David Marinus's book, what I promise you is you will start reading everything that he's written because it's amazing. David, thank you for your time. Congratulations on the book.
Great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Same here. We'll talk again. Thank you.
Yep.
Oh, what gorgeous music. You know that is from Les Miserables, and I am so thrilled that it is coming back to Chicago. It's playing here at the Cadillac Palace Theater from July 9th to 27th. That song was sung by the character Fantine. It was from one of the anniversary shows, but joining me is the woman who is playing Fantine in the Chicago production when it's here. So happy she's with me, Mary Kate Moore. Thank you for joining me for the podcast here on WGN.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So you and I were chatting before. It turns out that the much of this cast was here a few years back, still touring with it. You were with the show, but not in the role of Fantine. So how has that changed?
It was very exciting. At that time, I was in the ensemble of the cast, and I was understudying Fantine. So about 6 months into the tour, I was bumped up to playing the role full-time, and It was an exciting responsibility to take on, but I've loved doing it since then. It's been about a year and a half since I took over.
Wow, it's like the dream, hoping the person who's playing Fantine somehow finds another gig somewhere, right?
Yeah. It worked out very nicely for me and a couple other cast members, so I've been loving it.
And I have interviewed some of the folks that you do appear with, and they're just phenomenal. What is it about Les Mis? I mean, the show's been around over 20, I don't know, I think we're 30 years now at this point. But this show,
30 years,
so strong. What is it? Is it the music? What is it about this show that just keeps it forever in our hearts?
I think that the music is the main thing. It's what makes it so well known. You know, everybody has either seen an image of that red flag waving during One Day More, or they've heard I Dreamed a Dream sung by Susan Boyle or someone else on live television. Everyone knows On My Own. And so those are the things that I think keep people coming back to see it. But then as soon as they're in the theater and they're watching the show, they're reminded of the timeless story. I think that We're dealing with very human subject matter, stuff that we all experience every day. Even though the show takes place in 18th century France, it's still incredibly relatable to audiences today. So I think that's what helps. After people see the show, it spreads word of mouth, not only to come and see the incredible music, but to watch this really timeless story play out as well.
You know, Mary Kate, I know, look, you've appeared in so many shows. You've been in Into the Woods and Rocky Horror and Spring Awakening. And by the way, and I know you were Grisabella in Cats, which is also coming to Chicago next week. So if Grisabella gets sick, I'll be interviewing her. I'm going to throw your name over to that theater so you can run over there, too.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I might have to pay you 10%. You're my new agent.
Let's do it.
Wow.
So you've been in such classic shows. Talk about what it's like to appear in an iconic show like Les Miserables, especially with somebody who's got Sondheim behind you and Andrew Lloyd Webber. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're doing the biggies.
Yes. Yeah, I've kind of hit all of, like, the classic 80s musical theater divas. But I think that what has really helped me a lot specifically with Sondheim experience was everyone who knows Sondheim and is a fan of his knows that he's a story-based composer and lyricist, and so much of what he does is the lyrics and the characters that he creates. And so as an actor, doing any kind of Sondheim piece is so exciting because there's so much to get into. You know so much about your character. And so I think what I'm loving about this production of Les Mis is that we were really approaching the story as actors and not as singers. You know, the music is so famous, and it will always be beautiful, and it will always be so lyrical to sing, but we were really encouraged by the creative team of our show, by our directors, to think about what it is that our characters are going through and be honest with the storytelling and know that the music will kind of take care of itself. So what I really loved about my Sondheim experience was that I was able to flex my acting muscles, and I think that that helped a lot, especially with this particular version of the production of Les Mis.
It's
very actor-driven.
Great answer, and that's just such insight. Now, for folks who said, you know what, I saw Les Mis 30 years ago, as I did. I also saw it 5 years ago. It is coming with new staging, new scenery.
It is.
Again, I don't know. So can you kind of define for us a little bit what is different in the experience for folks who have seen the show years ago?
Sure. Well, it will still be the story that you know and love. It will still be the music that you know and love. We have some brand new, beautiful orchestrations that I think work incredibly for the show. Also taken care of by the lyricist and composer, Claude Michel and Alain Boublil. Those two kind of came back and revamped some things. But then, as far as the scenery goes, my favorite new aspect is that a lot of people don't know that Victor Hugo, the author of the Les Miserables novel, was also a really prolific painter. But at the time that he was alive, he didn't want his audiences to think of him as a painter. He wanted them to see him as an author. So he hid his paintings away, and a lot of them were recovered after he passed. And we use them now in the set as kind of live projections behind all of the moving physical set pieces on stage. So for the majority of the show, you'll not only be watching Victor Hugo's story, but you'll see his artwork projected behind us, which is very cool. It's really fun to be a part of
and actually,
that sort of artistic experience.
You almost have to be listening to this podcast to know that that's the case, right? Because I don't think I would be in the audience and realize that that's what I'm seeing.
Yeah, correct. I think that there might be a little something about it in director's notes, depending on whether or not the Playbill has that here in Chicago. But yeah, that is a little known fact about our production.
Do you feel, is there a responsibility in playing a character like Fontaine in a show like Les Miserables? I mean, do you sort of say, oh, that's another gig on my resume. You're proud and I get that. But do you sort of say, now this one's kind of heavy. I really can't mess this up.
I think that we all kind of feel that way. The show is just so well known, not only in the musical theater community, but just across the world. And so we don't take it lightly, that is for sure. And sometimes, you know, at this point, we've done almost 700 shows. So remembering what it is that we're performing and being really present with it on stage, you know, when I allow myself to think about the fact that I'm singing I Dreamed a Dream, something that Patti LuPone made famous, I mean, that's pretty incredible for a musical theater performer like me. So it's very humbling and it's definitely a responsibility, but I think we do it pretty well. I'm very proud to be a part of this cast.
I think so. And I have a friend.
People should come out and see us.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to be there opening night. You're going to see me. And
Actually,
a friend of mine I went to school with, Greg Gettleman, played Javert years ago. So I always felt that I should be playing Jean Valjean, but nobody would cast me. So, you know, what are you going to do? It's really.
Man, missed opportunities.
It happens. Mary Kate Moore, who plays Fantine in Les Miserables. It's at the Cadillac Palace. Such a glorious theater. You've been in that space before, right?
I have, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Beautiful. Can't wait to be back.
Such a glorious theater. From July 9th to July 27th, BroadwayInChicago.com is where you can get the tickets. Let me invite you to break legs every night you are in Chicago and, of course, everywhere you are. By the way, where are you coming in from? I know you're just performing elsewhere. Where are you coming in from?
Well, you know, we actually are fresh off of a cast layoff, so we've all had a little vacation before we came here. Visiting family. Yeah. So we're all going to be nice and fresh for
You are nice
night.
And fresh for our opening night.
Palace.
Well, you'll see me waving to you from the third row on the aisle. And I just know you'll have a great run back here in Chicago. I can't wait to see it again. Les Miserables, the Cadillac Palace, July 9th, July 27th. Mary Kate Moore earning that role of Fontaine as we will see her. Congratulations. And I will see you soon. Thank you, Mary Kate.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.